Today's Today Show will be on Case 52 in the Kienlu, the Hikigan Roku. Case 52 is entitled Joshu's Stone Bridge. Main subject. A monk said to Joshu, "The stone bridge of Joshu is widely renowned. But coming here, I find only a set of stepping stones." Joshu said, "You see only the stepping stones and did not see the stone bridge." The monk said, "What is the stone bridge?" Joshu said, "It lets donkeys cross over and horses cross over." Secho's verse, "No show of transcendence, but his path was high." If you've entered the great sea of Zen, you should catch a giant turtle. I can't help laughing at old Kanke, his contemporary, who said, "It is as quick as an arrow, a mere waste of labor." So this is day two of our sesshin, and as you know, day two can be a challenging day. You know, when you get up, you're a little more tired, and your legs hurt a little bit more than they did yesterday. In fact, you know, often day two is the most challenging day. It's when people really have second thoughts about coming to sesshin. It's the most significant day for that very reason. You know, so much of our lives is based upon capability and competence. So I myself am an English teacher. And, when I teach, writing, as I often do, I'm really quite, I've been doing it for 40 years, and I'm quite good. And I take a lot of pride in what I do. I take a lot of pride in being a very capable teacher. I have students of mine who go on and go to law school, and they write me a letter and say, "Oh, now that I'm writing for the Law Review, I thank you so much." You know, and I keep those letters. You know, and when I am teaching younger teachers how to teach, you know, I use my skill, my knowledge, everything I've picked up, and it really feels wonderful to be competent that way, to be skillful that way. I know how to solve that problem. You know, step in, solve the problem. I teach literature, and I'll read a paragraph to my students, and they'll just sort of like, "Oh yeah, okay." But then we'll look at the paragraph again, and I'll start to like peel off the layers of the paragraph. And when it works, you know, they're sort of like in awe. It's like they just read it, and now I'm showing them things in the paragraph they never saw before. And some of them are thinking about lunch, you know, that's the way it goes. But some of them are really, you know, it's like, "Wow, how did you do that?" Right? And it feels so good to be able to be capable and competent. And a lot of our identity is tied in with being capable and competent. You know, I spent a long time getting a degree, advanced degree in English. And I have friends who are like engineers and scientists, and they too spent a long time like acquiring expertise. And, you know, it's wonderful. You know, you're an apprentice for a long time, and then you get this expertise, and then you you're actually consulted. One of my friends who I went to college with, Larry Sullivan, is an attorney, and he's just about to retire after being a city attorney for many years. And, they don't want him to retire because he's such a good city attorney. And they're saying, well, stay part-time, we'll subcontract, that sort of thing. So capability and competence, right? So wonderful to have those things. It's so wonderful to be able to step into a problem and say, oh, I see the problem. I know how to solve this. It's like, oh, wow. But in life, outside of our, and sometimes even in our specializations, right? Sometimes there's problems we don't know how to solve. So it does sometimes happen that I'll be working with a student, and I really don't know what to do. The student's problems are problems that are so complicated that I really don't know how to help the student. Or, sometimes I'll be working as an editor. I do some editorial work too, and I'll look at a piece and, I really don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do. And that's an uncomfortable feeling, right? Not knowing what to do, not knowing how to go forward. It's so gratifying to be able to pull out of your sleeve your expertise and say, I know what to do. And when you don't know what to do, it's a very uncomfortable feeling in your field, right? But it's even more uncomfortable in life, right? It's more uncomfortable in life. So often in life, we don't know what to do. We don't know how to move forward or solve a problem. And when that's the case, we don't have any tools, right? Or we can't necessarily rely on our familiar tools. So, situation with somebody in my family who has gotten herself in a very difficult situation financially by being quite a risk taker, right? And so this person has now put her house in jeopardy because she was investing in a business that didn't work out, and I don't know what to do, right? I really don't. Some of the session I've been actually thinking about what to do because I don't know how to solve her problem, and I've certainly had issues like that in my own life. Years ago, my brother had a business. My brother was a businessman in Virginia Beach, Virginia. If you know anything about Virginia, that's in the southern part of the state. And my brother's business was going really, really well. He owned a store, an import store. Basically, they sold high-end Middle Eastern carpets. My brother's partner was a very nice man named Joseph Shaya, a Syrian. And he let my brother use the name Shaya for the company. My brother owned this company called Shaya Carpets. People would buy these very expensive, beautiful rugs, which I could never afford, And his business was going so well, and then his landlord decided to sell the building that my brother had been using for like 25 years. My brother didn't have the capital to buy the building. you know, and he came to me and asked me, you know, would I like to sort of go in with him on this? And I really didn't have resources to help. I really couldn't. So, you know, I was in this quandary for a long time. You know, I love my brother. I want to help my brother, but I don't know how to help my brother. And you know, I didn't have, I'm an English teacher. I'm not a financier. I didn't have the skills to deal with this problem. And, you know, I often, there are other problems like this. I'm sure you've been in similar situations where, you know, you're out of your wheelhouse. And you don't know what's right and you don't know what's wrong. And you don't know how to go forward. Right? And when we're in that situation, it's very uncomfortable. My sister has a son who, when he was a teenager, really was posed a lot of sort of like behavior issues. You know, my sister is a very outgoing person, and she's very gregarious. She loves people. She's so outgoing, and she has a huge list of friends and so on. And her son, my nephew, has turned out to be a nice young man, but at that time he was having a lot of problems. He was very withdrawn. He would stay in his room all the time. He had no friends. He would just surf the internet. My sister came to me and she said, Kurt, I don't know what to do with him. You know, I don't know. I don't have the skill set to help him. I know he's in trouble, right? I mean, I know he's in trouble psychologically, existentially. You know, she was even afraid that he was, you know, looking at stuff on the internet. The internet is full of sort of crazy misinformation, right? Fortunately, he didn't show up with a MAGA hat one day, but she was frightened that that could happen. And, you know, she would try to talk to him, and she has two sons, and one of the sons, the younger son, is more like my sister. He's more gregarious. He's friendly and outgoing. He's charming, really. He's like a charmer. If you hang out with my younger nephew, he's just so cute. Because he's earnest and he's not afraid of saying something inappropriate. But the older boy was a little bit more withdrawn and like antisocial. And my sister would say, you know, I don't know what to do, you know. So you know, when we're in those situations, there's so many different ways of being in that situation, right? Where, you know, basically you've developed the skill set either in your professional life or in your personal life. We all have like a repertoire of how we deal with problems, how we deal with situations. And you know, sometimes life throws us a curveball and we, you know, reach into our repertoire and we don't have any of the equipment we need to solve the problem. You know, this probably sounds familiar. I think we've all been there in one way or another. And, you know, and this koan is really about this situation, right? You know, it's about being outside of our comfort zone or being in a place where we don't feel we have access to the means to solve our own problem, right? That's really what the koan is getting at. So let me go back to the koan for a minute. A monk said to Joshu, the stone bridge of Joshu is widely renowned, but coming here, I find only a set of stepping stones. So basically, Joshu was famous for this teaching of the stone bridge. And, you know, all over China, when people would hear the name Joshu, they'd say, oh, the stone bridge, Joshu. I know who you're talking about, right? So Joshu would talk about the Dharma, about Buddhism, and he'd talk about Zen, he'd talk about Chan. And he'd talk about something called the Stone Bridge. And he became famous for this teaching of the Stone Bridge. So anyway, during this period in his life, Zhaozhou would go to different temples and present himself at different places and stay and practice with the monks or nuns there. And sometimes a monk would challenge him, would ask him a question designed to sort of test his insight. And these questions weren't always like friendly questions. Sometimes they were combative or pejorative, right? So on this occasion, Zhaozhou comes to this temple and basically he's presenting himself to the temple master, who would look at his papers and let him stay. And then he's probably taking a seat on the tan, on the row of cushions, being a regular monk. But during the break period, some young monk comes up to him and basically sort of like challenges him. Now, if you think about it, it's pretty remarkable that Nansen did this. You know, the other day I was talking about the fact that my teacher, Genki Roshi, was in his 40s before he came to the United States. And I think that's a remarkable thing, that a person in his, I'm in my 60s, so 40 looks young, but to be in your 40s and completely change everything in your life and come to a strange country, that takes a lot of courage, or maybe courage isn't right, the right word. You know, that's what Genki Roshi did. And Zhaozhou was like this too. Zhaozhou studied with a teacher named Nan Chuan. When he was like 18, Zhaozhou became the student of Nan Chuan. And he stayed with Nansen, until Nan Chuan died in his 80s. And Zhaozhou was in his 60s. And everybody said, well, you know, Nan Chuan has died. Obviously, Zhaozhou will take over the temple for Nan Chuan. But Zhaozhou didn't do it. To everybody's amazement, he just set out across China. At that time in China, there were these things, there were temples all over China. And you could present yourself at any temple, and you had to have papers that said you were a monk or a nun in good standing. And if you presented your papers, they'd say, come in, here's your bunk, here's your blanket, dinner is at, you know, 5:30, and be ready to meditate. So it was like a university system almost, right? So anyway, Zhaozhou picked up, went out on the road, and he would go to all these temples where there were famous Zen masters. So he would go to, he met Rinzai's teacher, right? Obaku, Wang Bo. And there are records of his exchanges with Wang Bo. So it would be like if I took a vacation from our community and just went around the country and did a koan training with different teachers. And I'd get in line, I'd go in, a teacher would give me a koan, and the person might know me and give me a koan, and it would be a test. It would be like, okay, let's see. You know, Pete, you say you're a Zen master, you say you're an accomplished practitioner. Let's see what you can do with this koan, right? Actually doing something like that takes a lot of courage or a lot of something. Maybe it's not courage. We'll get to that a little later. But the willingness to be wrong, the willingness not to know, the willingness to be stuck, that's really unusual, right? Most people stand on ceremony, you know? So when most Zen masters going to a temple wouldn't just present their papers and say, give me my bunk, give me my blanket, and I'll be on the ton in, you know, an hour. Most Zen teachers would write a letter in advance and say, I'm the great Joshu, student of Nansen, and I'm coming to your temple so that I can, you know, be your honored guest. You know, but Joshu wouldn't be like that. He'd just show up. And, you know, basically people could test him. You know, that we know that Joshu was a quote-unquote great Zen master. So you think, oh, I'm sure he handled himself okay. But actually that takes courage, or that takes something, you know, something special to put yourself at risk like that. You know, it's like you read sometimes about these people who are, they finish their careers and then they turn around and they go back to school, or they start a second career. And sometimes it's a totally new career, right? It's like they've accomplished enough to maybe retire, but instead they turn around and pick up something totally new. And that takes something special to be willing to start all over again and be making mistakes right and left and be in the wrong, right? So that's the kind of person Joshu was, right? Joshu goes to this temple, and a monk comes up to him and confronts him. See, a monk sees Joshu and says, "Oh, you're the great Joshu, renowned for the teaching of the stone bridge. Everybody talks about Joshu and his stone bridge, but when I look at you, all I see are a bunch of stepping stones." So he's saying, You just look like a 66-year-old man. You don't look like you're anything special. And when I look at you, I don't see a magnificent stone bridge. I see a couple of rocks in the mud, basically. See, so it's kind of an insult, right? Or definitely a challenge. And Joshu says, you say I look like stepping stones because all you've seen are the stepping stones. Wait till you see the bridge. Wait till you see the bridge. The monk said, "What bridge? What is this bridge?" And Joshu said, "It lets donkeys cross over and it lets horses cross over." So, you know, nobody likes being out of his comfort zone. Nobody likes being trapped in a conundrum or in a situation not of your own making and not with no clear exit strategy or forward strategy. And if you think about it, you know, Sesshin does that to people all the time. You know, what Sesshin does is to sort of train you to be in that situation. Because, you know, there's something incredibly frightening and unpleasant sometimes about being in that situation. But on the other hand, you know, that's where real transformation becomes possible. You know, on day one of Sesshin, if you've done Sesshin before, you know the drill, you know how to handle this. But on day two of Sesshin, you know, you're getting tired, and sometimes we begin to have to struggle with our obstacles. You know, on day two of Sesshin, if you're not struggling with your physical difficulties, you can be struggling with your mental difficulties, right? So, you know, I can always remember when I first started doing Sesshin, and I have to say, you know, Sesshin has always been for me, there's nothing in the world like Sesshin, if you think about it, right? There's nothing else that humans do that's like this, right? If you've been through a lot of Sesshins, you go, oh yeah, Sesshin. But if you think about what it really entails, it's just an amazing invention. It's this process of transformation. And It's a collective process that involves all of us. You know, so at any rate, you know, when I would go to Sesshin at first, for the first couple of years, the pain, the physical aspect was all I could deal with, right? And just getting through the Sesshin was a real challenge. You know, my legs hurt so much. My legs would just be screaming by around the middle of the second day. And I tried different strategies. You know, at one time I decided that hot showers would help. You know, so I would, every time there was a break, I'd run in and take a hot shower, you know, and I was very clean, and it did help for a little while, but it didn't really solve the problem, right? You know, your legs would be a little more limber for a while, and then they'd begin to tighten up again. But, you know, the physical difficulty got to be sometimes insurmountable, right? And you sit there and you think, you know, how am I going to get through this Sesshin? What am I going to do? And last night, I have to say, somebody came in and said something in Dokusan that was so profound that I felt like bowing to this person because the person had said something so profound. Everything you say in Dokusan is confidential. It's between you and me, but I don't think this person will mind if I share with you what the person said. The person said, you know, I'm having a lot of physical pain. But when I think about trying to get through 5 days of this, I can't stand it. And I thought, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. You know, my legs hurt too. And then the person said something which was like the voice of the Bodhisattva of wisdom. The person said, it occurred to me that instead of trying to think about 5 days, all I have to do is be in this moment. It was like, ah, yes, that is so true, right? It's like, oh, now that's insight, right? You don't have to think ahead to 5 days. Just be present in this moment, and then this moment, and then this moment. See, so at that, for that person, you know, this experience of being blocked or being trapped opened up something really wonderful, really like wisdom. That's like transcendental wisdom, right? You know, so this person was blocked and trapped, didn't know where to turn. And, you know, sitting on the cushion, struggling with pain, going into ushin, going into shunyata. And it's like something comes out, right? Something comes out. And, you know, suddenly there's the answer, right? This is the koan process, right? There's the answer. Just be in this moment. And the person tried it and said, when I'm just in the moment, the pain goes away. Pain diminishes, right? It was like, I couldn't believe it. It was real wisdom. So it was a moment of deep insight that comes from being out of ammunition, out of ideas, out of strategies, right? Nobody likes to be there. But when we're there, we can get into contact with true wisdom. See, that's the idea. And for more advanced practitioners, same thing in a slightly different way. You know, if you've been practicing for a while, you know, you're used to the pain in your legs perhaps. But, you know, on day two of Sesshin, we begin to play mind games with ourselves, right? So when I first started practicing, the pain was a big deal. But after that, you know, I began to have these sort of like mental obstacles in my practice. So, you know, I would be around day two, I would start to say things like, you know, I'm never going to wake up. I'm never going to wake up. You know, I would get angry and then I'd be despondent. And I talked about the fact that when I started doing Zen meditation, it seemed like everybody else in the group was better than I was. So, you know, people would go into the Dokusan room and they'd be in there for like 15 minutes. They'd be, would be, what are they talking about? You know, like, clearly the person had a good response to the koan. And you know, people would come out of the Dokusan room with a little smile on their face. I'd look up and I could see somebody coming out of the Dokusan room, like, you know, they weren't gloating, they were just happy, right? You know. So I would see somebody go into the Dokusan room, come out with a smile, go into the Dokusan room, they'd be in there for 15 minutes, come out with a smile. And I'd go into the Dokusan room, and it was like as soon as I got in and presented, the meeting was over. It was like, goodbye, you know. And so, you know, this would happen to me fairly often. It took me a long time to pass the breath perception koan. Just watching my breath, I had a hard time not thinking all the time. And so I would be thinking, and trying to find something interesting to say to Genki instead of speaking from the heart mind, from kokoro. And Genki would just ring the bell because I was not able to see that I could become one with the breath. So I would get into these funks, F-U-N-K, you know that word. You know, around day two, I would begin to get sad. You know, like things were hopeless. You know, it's like things are hopeless. You know, I'm a hopeless Zen student. I'll never solve this problem, right? And I wouldn't leave, but you know, I definitely would get, you know, down in the dumps, you know. And you know, around day three or day four, kind of like just blindly sitting, you know, trying to just going through the motions, and then, you know, something would often happen. You know, it would be like all of a sudden my mood would lift. And I would begin to feel, you know, like safe, at home, like at home, and grounded or connected. You know, around day four of Sesshin, I would suddenly find myself just feeling like, you know, I love it here. I love this. I love these people. You know, my legs hurt like hell, but I really love being here. And I love these people. You know, and there was no reason. If somebody said, well, what's the reason? You know, have you solved your koan? No. You know, but something, when we're in that situation, we could get very dark, very down. And that's a human response to being blocked, right? To being, to having challenges, you know, that are often totally undeserved challenges. And nobody wants to be there. And, you know, in our everyday lives, we often develop strategies not to be there, which involve, like, diverting ourselves or looking away or, you know, behaviors that will remove the stress but not solve the problem. So there's a lot of, like, compulsive behaviors that take the stress sensation away, but they involve, like, doing things that aren't good for us, or distracting ourselves, you know. So, you know, you can do those on the cushion too at times. But, you know, sooner or later, you get to this place where, you know, you discover there's, it's like you think you are hanging in space, right? You're just hanging in space, and there's nowhere to put your feet. Or you're dropping in space, better yet. You know, sometimes, not only in koan training, but sometimes in our everyday lives, we just feel like the ground has dropped away from us. And there's no way we're going to stop falling. And then all of a sudden we realize, you know, I'm not falling. You know, somehow all of this is okay. There's something holding me up. Something holding me up. You know, this is not a fantasy. You know, this is a kind of deeper reality that we don't normally see. You know, a lot of times in life, even if you don't practice Zen, it's like you think you're at your last you've made your last move. You know, you're out of ideas. You don't know what to do. And suddenly something just presents itself. It just presents itself. And you realize this has been here all along, this option or this state of mind. You know, I remember Genki Roshi talking about a session where he had a lot of issues himself. You know, Genki Roshi had an inferiority complex, I guess you could say. And he said, you know, what, at one session he just realized, you know, I could just as easily be happy. You know, why don't I just be happy? And I guess he had suffered a lot of these self-doubts and this self-laceration, right? And I think he just realized, you know, something's holding my feet up. You know, Genki Roshi became a person who could just pick up and go to America and handle the situation. It's just like he had discovered the stone bridge. He had discovered Joshu's stone bridge. You know, if we trust, I said earlier, it took a lot of courage, chutzpah, and guts for Genki Roshi to pick up and come to the United States, right, at 45 or something. But really, it's not just those things, although he certainly had courage. It was that he had trust. You know, every morning when we recite the sutra, the Xin Xin Ming, we say, one with the trusting mind. And, you know, if you were to ask me, what is Zen about? You know, most people say Zen is about enlightenment. And it is. It's about enlightenment. But enlightenment is about trust. You know, it's like deeper fundamental trust. It looks like there's nothing to hold us up, but there's a stone bridge always there, and it lets horses cross and donkeys cross. And, you know, we by practicing Zen, we learn how to find that stone bridge over and over again. You know, we learn that, you know, even though there doesn't seem to be anything to support us, we need to act from a place of trust. You know, and I would say, based on my own experience, that when I take decisions, when I act from a place of fear, those are often like my worst decisions, right? When I'm acting from a place of fear, which is a human thing to do. You know, it makes sense that when we're afraid, we close up. It's like we close up. And we don't want to do anything that would make us vulnerable or precarious. But actually, that's often the worst strategy when you're in a difficult situation. When you're in a difficult situation, it really helps to get to be outer directed, right? To connect with friends, to try new things, to get out and take a walk, right? We want to close up when we feel like we're under threat or we're under siege, but that's the worst strategy. We tend to make our worst decisions when we're afraid. And by the way, even people who are like gamblers, they're actually not making good decisions either, and they think they're making free, bold decisions, but they're not. They're actually all acting very compulsively out of fear. But you know, when we act from a place of trust, you know, I think it really is transformative. And just coming to Sesshin, as you all have, is an expression of your deep trust, right? Just being here is a beautiful manifestation of your trust, not only in Zen, but in life. You know, everybody in this room has a deep trust in life, you know, or you wouldn't be here. Right, and Zen is about learning how to trust. Right, learning how to deepen your trust in life. So, you know, koan practice puts us again and again in a situation where we're blocked, and we don't know how to. We don't know where to turn. We don't know what to do. And you know, we can feel like the blues on day two, or we can feel despair, or we can beat ourselves up. But, you know, sooner or later, we learn how to take a step in thin air, and we find we're not dropping infinitely down into the abyss, that the world is opening up before us in a way we didn't foresee. So that's about day two, that's about koans, that's about Zen, and that's about life. So pretty good. Joshu Stone Bridge, main subject. A monk said to Joshu, "The Stone Bridge of Joshu is widely renowned. But coming here, I find only a set of stepping stones." Joshu said, "You see only the stepping stones. You don't see the bridge yet." The monk said, "What is the stone bridge?" Joshu said, "It lets donkeys cross over and horses cross over." In other words, it doesn't judge. It doesn't judge. It says, this is life now. I have to connect with my life now. And if not from a place of fear, but from a place of trust. So whether it's a magnificent horse or a little donkey, this open-heartedness doesn't discriminate. If a donkey comes across the bridge, it's the Buddha. If a horse comes across, if a stallion comes across the bridge, it's the Buddha. Sutra's verse, no show of transcendence, his path was high. If you've entered the great sea of Zen, you should catch a giant turtle. I can't help laughing at old Kanke, his contemporary, who said, it is quick as an arrow, a mere waste of labor. So, in other words, don't sweat it. Just trust the process, okay? The answer will come quick as an arrow if you trust the process, okay? So please trust the process and live in trust.